everybody. My name's Christy Miller, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Boy, you are beautiful. It looks better from up here. I was having fun until right now. I want to give a heartfelt thanks to the board for asking Jim and me up here this weekend. It has been very, very special to come spend some time with some old friends like Jim and Mickey and Marge and George and meet lots of new friends. It's always special to do that. But this place is really spiritual and healing and peaceful. Jim and I really needed that. We spent our Friday walking down the fiery gizzard path down by the waterfalls, and I've never been on a hiking trail like that before. It was absolutely fabulous. And I commented as we came back that I also couldn't remember the last full day that Jim and I had had alone or to spend time together. And so that was a real gift, and I thank you for that. We needed it very, very much. I still want to be like Jim Hawkins when I grow up. I will stand by that. Now, Jim, I don't want to look like him, sweetheart. But I do want to act like him. You know, I want to be 37 years sober with that much enthusiasm and love and generosity of spirit. I do want that. And it's people like you that set the pace, that are still here. For those of us coming in and growing one day at a time, that let me know that I don't ever have to leave this fellowship, and I hope I don't ever have to. I have a story to tell about two guys named George and Bill. They came into Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober together. They kind of remind me of Jim and George a little bit in that long-term friendship, have walked down the path for a long time. And they just had a lot of joyous years of sobriety together. But Bill got very ill, and it was apparent that he was soon going to die. And when that became so, Joe went to him and said, Bill, he said, we know you're going to die. And he said, and I know you're going to go to heaven. And I said, I want you to do me a favor if you can. If you get up to heaven and there's absolutely any way possible for you to come back and let me know if there's Alcoholics Anonymous in heaven, I want you to do it. And Bill said he'd do that. And soon after that, Bill died. Well, it was about 3 days after Bill's death, Joe was home alone one evening, and Bill came back to him. And he said, Joe, I've got good news and I've got bad news. And Joe said, well, lay it on me. What is it? And he said, well, the good news is, there's Alcoholics Anonymous in heaven. And he said, oh, that's glorious. And he said, but the bad news is you're speaking tonight. That's kind of how I feel right at this moment. Before I get into my story, I do want to tell you a little bit about our family. Alcoholism is that self-centered disease, and I feel a lot of times when I get into all that, that they kind of get lost in the chaos of it. Y'all met Jim this morning, and Jim, of course, to me, is a very special man. I learn from Jim every day of our marriage, and I'm truly grateful to him, his perseverance, his love, and mostly to the program of Al-Anon, for being there for us that could save our marriage and let us go on to other things. I need to tell you, though, that deep in the throes of my alcoholism, I think it was right towards the tail end of it, and Jim was going to Al-Anon like crazy, he came to me one day, and he sat down, and he said, we need to talk. And I said, okay. And we sat down, and he was real serious, and he said, Christy, he said, you remember those vows we took when we got married, the one in sickness and health and, you know, for richer, for poor, till death us do part? And I said, yeah, I remember them very well. And he said, well, sweetheart, he said, we're going to have to change those vows. From here on out, it's one day at a time. That was not funny to a practicing alcoholic. It was not funny. I've never been so threatened in my life. in the long run, it turned out certainly that was a gift. You know, when I began to get sober and try and put my relationship back together again with Jim, there was no doubt in my mind why Jim was still in this marriage. I knew he was there because he wanted to be there. And Al-Anon gave us that, and I'm eternally grateful for it. We have three beautiful daughters, and they are the joy and light of my life. They are just a lot of fun. They are 14, 10, and 8. And we really have a good time together. I am thankful each day to Alcoholics Anonymous that through my sobriety, I get to be a mother to those girls and cart them across town back and forth and shop with them and play with them. And we really do have a good time. I want to tell you a story, though, about our oldest daughter. It's my favorite story of them. She was about 7 years old when I got sober. And the last time I was in treatment, I was gone a long time. I was gone 3 months. And I'd been home from treatment about 6 months. And it was the middle of July. It was very hot. And Jim and I had been talking, and we just really needed to have a party for some of the people that Jim worked with. And so we planned this party, and as we planned the party, we naturally gave discussion to whether we should serve alcohol at it or not. And after a lot of discussion, we decided that it really would be appropriate if we served a little beer and a little wine. Well, it became Jim's job to go get that beer and wine, and he did. And he came home and put it in the refrigerator, and I proudly ignored it for 2 hours or so, and and then I had to peek in the refrigerator and see what he got, and he'd gotten a half gallon of white wine and a six pack of beer. I said, Jim, yeah, this is an afternoon snack. Who do you expect? And you know, he said, Chrissy, don't worry about it. This is my job. We have plenty. Well, he was right. We had plenty. Matter of fact, we had some left over. And so it was the next day on this hot summer day that my daughter Ray and I were standing at the refrigerator door looking. We'd opened it, and we were standing there looking for something to drink. And she saw that leftover beer and wine. She said, Mommy, what are we going to do with that? And I was being cute. I said, well, I could drink it. And she says, ooh, I don't think that's a good idea, Mommy. I said, well, why not, Ray? And she says, well, Mommy, if you drink it, you won't be home for Christmas. My daughter doesn't remember a lot about my alcoholism, but she remembers cause and effect. And I had my first drink when I was about 11 years old. I drank because I had a friend spending the night. We had parents who were social drinkers, and we started talking about alcohol and what it did, and we became curious, and we decided we wanted to try it out. So we went behind my father's bar, grabbed a bottle of scotch, went into our den, took off the top, and down it went. And it tasted terrible. And to the day of my last drink, I never drank scotch again. I didn't like the way it tasted. I genuinely didn't. But I loved the way it felt. And we got drunk that night, both of us. Betsy and I got drunk. And I'll just never forget looking over at Betsy, because Betsy got knee-walking, tongue-slurring, throwing-up kind of drunk, and I didn't. I got that kind of put-together, I-feel-good-I-can-conquer-the-world kind of drunk. And I remember standing in the mirror and looking at me and thinking I looked pretty good. And she was tongue slurring, knee walking, thrown up. And I remember at the ripe age of 11, looking at that situation and thinking, I like the way I feel. I know this is going to be a part of my life, but I will never, ever drink and be like her. And that was something that I fought to maintain to the day of my last drink. I was not successful at the end, but I was successful for a long, long time of putting down an awful lot of alcohol and dressing up and putting on my makeup and trying to walk straight and talk straight so that you wouldn't know how much I'd had to drink. I think I intuitively knew that it was not appropriate for women to be tongue slurring, knee walking, and throwing up. And so I fought for that not to happen. As Jim said, we met at Duke, we fell in love, we got married, and we set off on our trail of perfect living. And it was when we moved to Dallas, Texas for Jim to do his internship with that I crossed the line of addiction. And I did that through drug addiction. I know today that I did it because I was working as a head nurse on a cancer floor, and I did it because you can't tell them if you can't smell them. And I was terrified of going to work smelling like alcohol. And I don't know what really happened, except that the best way I can describe it is that I became extremely restless, irritable, and discontent. And I was just off center. And I found, as I was working one day, that what put me back on center was to take a couple of Tylenol with codeine off the medicine cart and put those into me, and things got better. Once I started doing that, it was a very short amount of time before I progressed into taking narcotics from the narcotic cabinet, and then got scared about being caught doing that, and so I stopped stealing drugs from the hospital and I started writing my own prescriptions. And I wrote prescriptions every day. I wrote a prescription for Percodan, for 36 of them. And I wrote that prescription every afternoon when I got off work, and I took 36 of them every afternoon before I went back to work the next day. And, I mean, I roared across that line. I did that for about 9 months. And for some reason, after about 9 months and changing jobs in the process, and one of the things I did, y'all, I changed jobs addicted to Percodan. And when you take 36 Percodan a day, it's got a lot of aspirin in it. And it'll make your ears ring. You think that bell rings. I mean, your ears ring all the time. And so I quit this job on the cancer floor, and I went to work in an operating room where everyone's mouths are covered up, and all you can see are their eyes, and my ears are ringing with bells. I couldn't understand a word anybody said. I just went around a lot nodding my head. That was a nightmare. But anyway, after about 9 months, my denial about what was going on broke for whatever reason. I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was addicted. I knew that I was very close to becoming arrested. I knew my world was going down the tubes. And that was the day when Jim came home that I told him what was going on with me. The reason I told Jim was because I didn't have a soul in Dallas that I could call a friend, that I could tell what was happening to me. And I was terrified of telling Jim. You know, my terror was that he was going to leave me. And I was surprised when he lovingly put his arms around me and said that he didn't understand everything that happened, but he did understand enough about addiction to know that there was hope and that I could get better. And that's when I started on my round of psychiatrists, and I withdrew from the Percodan, and I withdrew from the Percodan probably for about 4 days was as much as I could stand it, and then I started drinking. But I didn't tell anyone I was drinking. And I'd been drinking late one night while Jim was at the hospital, and it occurred to me that there might be one other person in this world that I could tell about what was happening to me, and that was our other mother who lived in Pine Mountain, who was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called her late that night, and I did say, "Lillian, I need you." And she was in Dallas, Texas, by about 4 o'clock the next afternoon. And when she got there, I sat her down in our living room, and I told her the story of my drug addiction. And she got this funny little smile on her face, and I knew I was in trouble. I knew I'd been real hasty in my actions, and sure enough, the first words out of her mouth were, "It's going to be okay. We can go to a meeting." And I thought, oh, why didn't I think of that? See, I'd been to visit their home in Pine Mountain, at her home and Joe's home when he was alive, and it was an AA home. It was a big Victorian Southern home with the wide front porch with the rocking chairs all around it, and there was always a huge coffee pot going in the kitchen. There are always drunks all over the house, and in those rocking chairs, rocking back and forth, talking about God and serenity and steps and things I didn't understand. You know, I was 20 years old when I was going to Pine Mountain, and God and Serenity were not on my list of priorities. And she said we were going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I immediately, you know, see, I'm going to end up in a rocking chair. Oh, God, what have I done? But I called her all this way, so off we went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told them the story of my drug addiction, and they smiled. And they tried to tell me about my alcoholism, and I smiled and said, no way, you know, I am a highly successful social drinker. I drink everyone under the table. It's no problem. Proud of it. And, you know, and I failed to tell them that, you know, I'd already had a quart of vodka that day, starting at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I just smiled, and Lillian stayed for a while, and we talked, and she left, and, you know, she told me to keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did, and I think I did to keep my world from caving in around me. I didn't know what else to do. By this time, the law had caught up with me, and I was going through a trial, and there was a chance I was going to go to jail, and, you know, things were not good. And so I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I also kept drinking a quart a day, and things did not get better. I wanted what you had. I just was not willing to quit drinking to get it. And so I had to keep drinking one day at a time. In 1980, we moved to Columbus, Georgia, and I knew we were taking the geographical cure. I'd been to enough meetings to know that wonderful little catchphrase, you know, y'all said it never worked, and I was going to prove you wrong, you know, how belligerent we get. And I stayed sober all the way from Dallas, Texas to Columbus, Georgia. It took us 2 days to drive. And I thought that I had really done something. And we got to Columbus and started unpacking our furniture, and I ran off to the grocery store to get some things, and lo and behold, there was a liquor store 2 blocks from our house, and I knew I was home. And I pulled in there, and I was off and running again. I ended up in treatment a few months later, and I wanted to get sober. I realized in treatment that I didn't want to live the way I was living anymore. I didn't want to live being a slave to the bottle, and I got out, and much to my amazement, I was drunk in 3 or 4 days. And in 10 days, I was back in the hospital drying out again. And it was Christmas of 1980 that Jim was on call that Christmas, and he was out at the hospital, and I put our little girl to bed, and I went to get out the presents from Santa Claus to put them under the Christmas tree. It was about 10:30 at night. And it occurred to me at that point, for the very first time, that I didn't have one gift for Jim for Christmas. And I was devastated. I just knew I'd made a major mistake. I've always adored Christmas, and nothing speaks louder to me than the self-centeredness of alcoholism and the fact that Christmas can come up, and the man who I knew I loved, I had nothing for. But being the good alcoholic that I am, I had to sit down and think about it. You know, there might be a solution to this problem. And after a few drinks and a lot of thinking, I came up with the solution. I knew that what Jim wanted more than anything in this world was for me to be sober. And so I sat down at our desk and I wrote out a note, and it said, "I will go to any lengths." And I put it in his stocking, and I poured myself another drink, and I went to bed. Jim swore that was a valid Christmas gift. I don't know, but 10 days later, I hit a bottom. After that Christmas, I began drinking with a vengeance that I knew that was going to kill me. I was no longer putting up my facade that I was coping, that I was taking care of things, that I wasn't drinking. And things were falling apart rapidly. And I hit a bottom on January the 3rd, 1981, and I called Lillian again. Lillian was down in Macon putting out the Georgia message, and she asked me to come down there and spend some time with her, and I did. I spent 4 days with her. Now, mostly I think what I did during those 4 days was shake a lot, and I didn't feel very well, and she talked. She talked the whole time I was there, and she'd take me to meetings, and we'd go to the AA office and during the day and go to meetings at night. And one night she said, "We're going to take a break," and I said, "Oh, thank you. It's So we went home. She made me listen to 3 tapes. And I tried to listen to the best of my ability. I knew I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I knew I didn't want to die from the disease of alcoholism. And finally she said, Christy, you know what you've got to do. You need to go home and get into this program and work these steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., and get sober, and you can be okay, and I'll walk with you. But go home and get to some meetings. And so finally I went home, scared to death, and I started going to meetings, and I started listening to what you had to say. I'd heard a lot of what you'd said because I could spout it back at you since I'd been to meetings. But I really didn't listen, and I really didn't apply it to me. And at that point, I began to try and do those things. I loved and trusted Lillian more than anyone I knew, and so she continued to be my sponsor. I felt like there was no one wiser than her, and she guided me well. I called her every day at 5 o'clock. And because she lived in Pine Mountain and it was long distance. So every day at 5 o'clock when the rates went down, I called her and we talked. And I got sober. And things got good. And I gave birth to our second daughter. And we were happy. And Lillian took us places and we went to lots of meetings. And we met lots of people like Jim and Mickey. And things were really good. I loved being sober. I loved being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became pregnant with our third daughter. And I remember it was about in the 6th or 7th month of my pregnancy that something began to happen in me. I remember as I would do my morning meditation and prayer that I felt just kind of all bottled up and blocked inside. And I felt like my prayers were just kind of rebounding back on me. And it was real uncomfortable. I just felt real dry. And Lillian was real ill at this time. She had both bad heart disease and cancer. And she was in and out of the hospital a lot. And I thought about talking with her about this. And then I thought, no, she's so sick. And this is no big deal. I'm tired. I'm pregnant. I'm busy. And it'll get better after the baby's born. I won't worry about it. And so I let it go. And I stopped trying to pray and meditate because it was so uncomfortable. I remember that I'd sit in meetings during this time, and believe me, this is all in hindsight, that I'd sit in meetings and people weren't talking right. They weren't sharing their experience, strength, and hope right. Or I just wasn't hearing anything. I was kind of there in body and not in mind. And once again, I told myself, you know, I'm pregnant, I'm tired, I'm busy, it'll get better after the baby's born. I'm not going to worry about it. I knew I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I could not pinpoint where that was coming from, why I felt that way. I just knew that I was. And every time I thought about talking about it, I'd think of how sick Lillian was and how much greater her problems were than mine. And I wouldn't say anything to her. Because I didn't know that even though my problems may not be as large as hers, they are my problems, and I need to share them. Because especially for me, being an alcoholic, if I don't do so, I may go back to the disease that can kill me. And I think about going to some of the other women in the program, and about that point, pride would raise its ugly head and say, oh, Christy, you can't do that. You know, if you go tell somebody how you're feeling and what you're doing, they might think you're not working a good program. Heaven forbid. I wasn't working any program. But my pride said, no, no, no. You know, don't do that. You know, you're 3 years sober. You should know what to do about this. You should be able to handle it. You should be able to rock through. You're pregnant. You're tired. We have a lady in our home group who calls that shoulding all over yourself. I agree with her. And I did that a lot. Well, Jessica was born, and nothing changed. I remember when Katie was born and I was in recovery, well, I was back in meetings, you know, 2 days after her birth. When Jessica was born, I dilly-dallied. it wasn't quite as important to get back. But I did, eventually. I got back after about a week. I kind of slipped into a meeting and slipped back out. And she was probably about 5 or 6 weeks old, and I had done nothing about all these feelings. When I decided that she'd had a particularly restless night the night before, and that she probably had the colic, and our doctor had given us a prescription for Paragard when I left the hospital with her, and I decided that that's what she needed for her restlessness. So I went to the drugstore, and I had the Paragard filled, and I never made it home with it. I drank it in the car. Have any of y'all ever had Paragard before? I mean, you know, you're really going for it when you can pick up a bottle of Paragard and just down it. And I did. And as it kind of wore off, I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? And alcoholism came roaring back. You know, it began to tell me the lies that I believed. Don't worry about this, Christy. Nobody ever has to know. I'll never tell a soul. And you don't have to worry about it because tomorrow's going to be different. Well, the next day, I was back at the drugstore. I had the prescription refilled. And again, I never made it home. And again, I went through the lies. No harm done. You've been pregnant and tired and busy and, you know, you deserve this. And I believed every one of them. And I believed my disease again when it said tomorrow's going to be different. And the next day was different. I was at the liquor store, and I was off and running. I'd always thought to myself that if I ever drank again, that I wouldn't be the kind that drank and tried to pretend like they weren't drunk, that I would just tell all of y'all to go away and leave me alone till I was through drinking, and no facades, no nothing. But that isn't the way I drink. When I drink, I put up a facade. That's just the way I do it. And so that's what I began again, drinking first thing in the morning, drinking all day long, trying to make everybody believe that I was okay, and I was dying. Now I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking again. But now you're my family. You're my friends. And I love you more than anyone in the world. And I was terrified. You know, don't get too close to me. Don't come up and hug me. I just felt like, yeah, I could be in a room like this and feel like I was absolutely, totally alone. And I was terrified. I was terrified you'd find out who I was. And at that point, what I felt like was the biggest hypocrite in the world. And I didn't know what to do about it. I'd been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years. I was drinking, and I had no idea what to do about it. It took almost 5.5 months for the idea to occur for the first time that I could tell you what was happening to me, and you would help me. But my disease was telling me the lies, you know, that you wouldn't understand, and I'd listened. But finally, after about 5.5 months, that idea occurred to me. And Lillian was still very ill. There was a couple that Jim and I spent a lot of time with them, and still do today. We've had dinner with them every Tuesday night after our meeting through thick and thin for the last 11 years. And I called Joe that afternoon. The only problem was when I called him, his Al-Anon wife, Libba, answered the phone. Now, any of y'all know that anybody who's been in Al-Anon for any length of time, they can smell alcohol over the phone, and I just didn't want Libba to be the first one to know. I mean, this is my best friend. I hung up. I didn't say a word. I hung up. And I waited a second, and I called back. She had the audacity to answer again. I hung up again. I absolutely could not talk to her. And I loved her dearly. Well, little did I know, after the second time I called, she turned around to Joe and said, "Joe, there is some drunk that is trying to get in touch with you, and the next time the phone rings, would you please pick it up?" And he did. And it was me, and I told him what was going on. And Joe and Libba came over that night, and 12-step, both Jim and me. I wanted more than anything in the world to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober. And that was certainly my intention when I called Joe that night. And that's certainly what I attempted to do. But a funny thing happened as I came back and picked up my white chip and tried to stay sober. I found I couldn't. I absolutely couldn't. I was so baffled as to what had happened. I was so disappointed. I was so angry in myself. I couldn't let go of what I thought I'd committed, the gravest crime that had ever been committed. And I couldn't let go of it and get back into recovery. And so I continued to drink. And I drank for a couple more months. And it was not soon after Jim had changed our marriage vows to the one day at a time that he also sat down with me one night. I'll never forget, it was a Thursday night, that he sat down with tears rolling down his cheeks. He said, "Christy," he said, "I know you may die from the disease of alcoholism." He said, "I want you to know that I know I'm powerless over it. I will take care of our children. If I have to hire a housekeeper, I will do that. But I've got to let you go and stop this game playing that you continue to put up, this act that you're not drinking, when I know you're drinking every minute you're awake. And so I'm going to let you go and do what you have to do. If you need me, I'll be there for you, but I'm going to let you go." And he walked out of the room. And I sat there, and a part of me cried. The part of me that wanted to be well just cried. And my alcoholism screamed with joy. It said, "Free at last, to drink any way I want to." And so in the next 76 hours, I drank about 5.5 quarts of I.W. Harper. And I was real sick. And that Sunday afternoon, I called Joe again, and I said, "I need to be in the hospital because I can't stop drinking at home." And he agreed, and I went into the hospital. I went into a psychiatric hospital that had an alcohol and drug program, and I stayed there 3 months. What happened to me while I stayed there was that as I dried out a little bit, I realized I was extremely depressed. And boy, this was a new experience to me, because up until that point, I was kind of one of these people who didn't believe in depression. You know, I believed that if you were down in the dumps or felt depressed, if you did a happy thing, you'd feel happy. I wasn't a big believer in depression. Well, that kind of changed my tune a little bit when I found how depressed I was. I mean, I was depressed. I didn't care if I got dressed. I didn't care if I put my makeup on. I didn't care if people came to see me, if they called. I just didn't care. And I stayed 3 months. And I finally told him, "I'm not getting any better here. I need to go home." And I went home, and it was in December. My plan was to go home and have Christmas for the children. I really wanted to do that. I had a lot of guilt about being away from them so long. And that was my intention. But after I'd been home about 3 days, I'd made so much progress on getting ready for Christmas that I knew I deserved one drink. And so I got two bottles, 2 quarts for my one drink, and I started drinking. My intention was to drink like I always drank, which was just to kind of keep me at that level where I could function without hurting and not be knee-walking, tongue-slurring drunk. And I started drinking. The next thing I knew, I woke up in the intensive care unit in one of our local hospitals. And Jim was on one side of me, and Joe was on the other side of me. Now, Jim and Joe tell this story totally different than I do. but this is my story. And I woke up, and I asked what I thought was a perfectly logical question. I looked at them, and I said, "What happened?" And this was the moment when I knew, you know, and I'd had suspicions before, but at this moment I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jim Miller had been to far too many Al-Anon meetings. Because when I asked that question, he looked at me and he said, "Christy, you had one drink." And he kissed me on the forehead, and they left. They left me there. And that's all I had. And I stayed there all night wondering what happened after I took that one drink. Well, about 8 o'clock the next morning, this lady who I meanwhile had asked to be my sponsor, along with Lillian, came bounding into that room with joy and glee, you know, as some sponsors can do, and bounced on the end of my bed and said, "Well, what have you learned from this little excursion, Christy?" I was still trying to figure out what happened. How could I figure out what I'd learned when I didn't even know what happened? And I knew that if I stayed quiet long enough that Diane was going to tell me what I'd learned from this situation, and she did. She informed me, she said, you remember there's a page in the big book where it talks about there comes a point in every alcoholic's drinking where when they pick up the first drink, it is no longer predictable what happens to them. And I said, yeah, I remember that. And she says, you're there. I said, well, great, I'm there. Well, it scared me. I was there. I mean, I'd been admitted with a blood alcohol level of 0.48. That's lethal. And but for the grace of God, I did not die. From what Diane tells me, somewhere in there in my drinking, I called her. And she came over to the house and found me. I'm very grateful for her. It was with a lot of grace and love. She let me throw vodka up all over her, and she has stayed my sponsor to this day, and I love her for it. I stayed sober after that. No, I stayed dry after that. For 9 months, I stayed dry. I went to meetings. I talked to Diane. I screamed. I yelled. I was depressed. I was angry. I was so angry, and that's where my depression was coming from. I was so angry. I was so angry at Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in many meetings and listened to people talk from the podium who would say, you know, they were getting off the track. And some old geezer from the back would come up after the meeting and say, well, you're getting off track, and if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get drunk. But let me tell you what you can do, and you don't have to pick up that first drink. And I was so angry because none of you had done that for me. Now, it's real hard to do that for somebody when they come in and smile and say everything's okay, and they just kind of talk the talk and pretend like it's all right and continue sponsoring people. You can't do it for people who don't let them see how, let you see how they're feeling. You know, it's not your job to read my mind. It is my job to bring me to you. But I was angry at you because I didn't know how else to be, you know. I was angry at Jim. Oh, I was furious at Jim. As he told you this morning, you know, he dug in and went to Al-Anon during this time. And he was doing okay. He woke up with a smile on his face every day, and it made me sick. And he'd smile, and he'd have a good day, and he was doing all right. And y'all told me he was doing all right. Y'all told me all the time, Christy, do you know how much you have to be grateful for? You have a wonderful husband, 3 beautiful kids, a beautiful home. You have so much to be grateful for. Let go and let God. And I'd be angry at you for telling me that. Because see, what I knew that y'all didn't know was that I didn't deserve him. And I didn't deserve those 3 beautiful children. Because in my eyes at that point, I was a helpless, hopeless drunk. And I wasn't worth it. And I didn't feel like I would ever get honest or sober again. I'd sit in meetings and listen to how it works, and that constitutionally incapable would kind of ring through my head. I think it rang through a few other people's head at some point too, but it rang through mine. But I was angry. Oh, I was angry at God. I'd heard talk in meetings about us paying our insurance policy, and I felt like I'd paid my dues. And God had let me down. Well, you remember, who stopped praying to whom? You know, I stopped praying to God 4 months before I picked up my first drink. He carried me for 4 months, graciously. But I blamed him. While I was in treatment there in Columbus, my minister came to see me one day. And when he sat down, I said, Bill, if you're here to talk about God, it's not the right time. And he said, oh, so you're angry at God, huh? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, get in line, honey. That got my attention. It means everything to me today. It didn't mean very much then. I mean, today, you know, what a gift that he gave me. He said, you know, it's okay. God loves you enough that it's okay for you to be angry at him. It's just okay. But most of all in all of this, even though I knew I was angry at you and God and Jim, most of all, I was angry at me. I could not forgive myself for giving up what I considered the most precious gift I'd ever been given. And I couldn't figure it out why I gave it up. I was so angry at me for willfully picking up that first drink, and I couldn't let go of it. So I stayed angry, and I stayed depressed, and I stayed stuck, and I stayed very dry. And when I reached 9 months, Diane called me and said, "Show up at the meeting tonight. I want to see you pick up that nine-month chip. Believe me, it's a miracle you haven't had a drink in 9 months." And I went to that meeting to pick up my nine-month chip, but I ran out the minute the meeting was over. And I remember driving home in my car and rolling my window down and taking that chip and throwing it as far as I could and screaming out that if this was what sobriety was like, I didn't want it. I didn't want to feel this way. I'd rather be drunk. The only reason I hadn't drunk for 9 months was I was convinced it would kill me. And it was at this point that I reached the point where I didn't care if it did. And it actually became my preference that it would. That was a Tuesday night. The next day I fired my sponsor. The day after that I fired my therapist. I hadn't talked much to Jim in weeks. And on Friday, September the 13th, 1985, I woke up and I knew that was the day I was going to get drunk, and I intended for it to be the day that I would end my life. I hadn't talked to God in those 9 months, but that morning, while I was in the shower, I shook my fist at him. I'd heard us talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous that no one ever got drunk who sincerely asked God to help keep him sober that day. And so this was my version of it. I shook my fist at God, and I said, "God, today's the day. I'm going to get drunk today, and my intention is to not live through today. And if you don't want that to happen, you need to do something about it, because that's what I'm going to do." Whew. You think I was arrogant? I mean, at 2 o'clock that afternoon, the phone rang, and it was Joe. Now, we saw Joe and Libba all the time, but this was the first time in months that Joe had called simply to ask me the question, "How are you?" And when he asked, I told him. And he said, "Christy, if that's what's going on, we're not going to let you go without a fight." And 10 minutes later, he was at our back door. And he came in and grabbed a cup of coffee, and he sat down, and he said, "Christy, we will go to any lengths. If I've got to stay here with you all afternoon, all night, I'll do it. We'll call the group. They'll come over. They'll stay with you. We'll get you through this. You know, you don't have to drink and you don't have to die." And I said, "Thank you very much, but I'd prefer if you left my home." And I kicked him out. I mean, I had the arrogance to scream at God to help me. He had the grace to send me Joe, and I had the audacity to kick him out. Well, I'd bought 2 bottles of vodka that morning. I'd gathered up all the pills in the house, and at 6 o'clock when our babysitter arrived, I scooped all that stuff up and put them in the car. And I went back inside the house, and I said goodbye to our children. I'll never forget pulling our little baby girl, Jessica was about 1, and pulling her up on my lap and giving her a hug and a kiss and telling her goodbye and not feeling anything. I was just dead inside. And I turned around and walked out of the house, and I checked into a motel and I started drinking. But remember, it's unpredictable what happens after we take the first drink. And after I'd had a few, I decided that there were a few things that my parents needed to hear before I died. And so I called them. And they lived in Hilton Head, South Carolina, and there I was in Columbus, Georgia. And to make a long story short, by the time I got off the phone with them, there were 2 ladies from Alcoholics Anonymous at our back door, at my motel room door. And to make another long story short, within 2 days, I was down in Statesboro, Georgia, at Willing Way Hospital. And I was kind of nothing when I got there. I'd lost all hope. I'd lost all willingness. I'd lost all of whatever that little ingredient it is inside of us that makes us willing to try just for one day to get sober. I didn't have anything left to try with. I felt like what I had done best was fail at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just didn't have anything left to try with anymore. And so I lay there for a long time. I literally lay in my room. And they let me. They loved me enough to let me do that. And after I'd been there about 3 weeks, I stole a razor blade one night. And I went back to my room and I started to cut my wrists. Because I just couldn't live in this nothingness anymore. And it was as I did that, I realized very simply, it was just a simple thought, that I really don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to die from alcoholism. And I knew that if I was going to live, that I was going to have to do it your way, one day at a time. And I also knew that if I was going to live, I was going to have to drop this angry wall towards God and let that be a part of my life again. Now, that's what I began to do. This was not a blinding spiritual experience. It was very quiet, and it was very slow. Mine was of the very slow kind. I mean, I kind of came out of this very slowly, and I came out of the depression very slowly, and I began to let God back into my life very slowly. And I stayed there for quite a long time after that. Me and let me do that. And then the day came when I had to come home, and I was terrified. You know, one of my biggest fears was that I'd used up Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd used you up, and you'd have nothing left for me. And I got home, and Diane met me, and I told her that fear. And she took this paperweight out of her pocket that has starfish in it. And she said, I want you to take this, Christy, and put it in your kitchen where you can see it every day so you'll remember what I'm about to tell you, so you'll know what to do with your fear. And she said, I want to tell you a story. She said, there was a man who was taking a vacation down on the coast, and he loved to walk the beach. And as he was walking the beach one day, he noticed that thousands and thousands and thousands of starfish were getting washed up onto the beach, and the sun was drying them out, and they were dying. And he loved nature. He loved starfish. So he began to stoop down and pick up a starfish and throw it back into the ocean, and stoop and get another one and throw it back into the ocean. And it was very tedious work. While he was doing that, a little boy came up to him and said, Mister, what are you doing? You can't possibly save all these starfish. And he said, I know that, but I think that this one's worth saving, and so's this one, and so's this one. And that's what I came back to. That's what y'all told me. I was worth saving. And so one day at a time, I began to get sober again. Lots of things have happened. We lost Lillian when I was about 2 years sober. I was terrified. I knew she was going to die. The night she died, Jim left and went to the hospital, and I stayed home. It was the middle of the night. So I stayed there with the girls, and I was amazed to find myself cleaning house in my turmoil. And then I stopped, and I ran in, and I called Diane. And I told her, I said, I know what I'm doing. I said, I know that I am so terrified that I'm going to lose everything this beautiful lady taught me. I'm not going to be able to remember all the wisdom and love that she shared with me. And Diane shared with me that she believed that I would find all of that every time I attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And how right she was. I still miss her. She wore a lot of hats for us. She was a grandmother to our children. She was our mother. She was our friend. She was my sponsor. She was so Alcoholics Anonymous. But she's still here every time I come to a meeting. And I'm grateful for that. There's still days when around 5 o'clock I have that urge to pick up the phone. And that's okay. When I was about 6, 7, 8 months sober, I had a friend who'd had a year of sobriety, and she drank again. And she called me one afternoon, and she was in trouble. And she didn't want to drink anymore, and she wanted to come stay with me for a few days. And she lived about 35, 40 miles outside of Columbus. And I said, I think I'd like that, but I need to check this out first, and I'll call you back. And I called my sponsor, and we talked about it for a long time. And I called Jim, and we talked about it for a long time. And they agreed that it would be okay for her to come up there, and that she could kind of detox at our house with support. Well, she came, and about an hour after she got there, I had to leave to go to a meeting. And I told her as I was leaving, I said, Lil, I said, when I get to the meeting tonight, I'm going to tell everyone you're here. I'm going to tell them what happened. One of the things that I found when I drank again is that people were scared to talk about the fact that I had drunk again. Even in Alcoholics Anonymous, people were scared to talk about the fact that I got drunk. I'd run into people and they'd say, oh, I saw one of your friends at a conference I was at. He asked how you were. I said, would you tell him? He said, I told him you were okay today. I said, did you tell him I got drunk? They said, no, that's for you to tell him. And I thought, if I'd had a heart attack, would you have told him that? You know, do we treat it as a disease or do we treat it as a secret within Alcoholics Anonymous? So that night when I went to the meeting, I told everyone that Lil was there and that she was sick. And that's all I did, was tell them that she was there. The next day was Saturday. About 9 o'clock in the morning, the doorbell rang. It was one of the men from the meeting at the night before. He said, you got any coffee? I said, you bet I do. And he came in, and we poured him a cup of coffee, and an hour later, the doorbell rang again. It was someone else from that meeting. And they came in and we poured them some coffee and began talking Alcoholics Anonymous. And an hour later, the doorbell rang again. And I am not embellishing this story when I tell you that that doorbell rang all day long. And people came to share their experience, strength, and hope with her. And the reason they did it is because they knew she was hurting. Because they knew she was sick. And God, I cannot tell you what an impression it made on me. She didn't stay sober, but I did. You know, and it taught me to bring it to you. You can't help me if I don't tell you what's going on with me. One of the things I found as I've been sober now is that I have not totally lost the compulsion to drink. I'm 6.5 years sober, and I don't have it every day. I did when I was first sober. But every once in a while, it comes back. And for me, when I say that, I mean I get restless, irritable, and discontent. And I just kind of categorize that as a desire to drink because it scares the fool out of me. I don't think I know enough to know, you know, when I'm going to pick up a drink or not pick up a drink. I didn't before, so I just don't even pretend to know, you know, if I'm getting close to the edge or not. But if I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, I kind of consider that a desire to drink. And it wasn't too many months ago that I was driving off to Warner Robins to a bowling tournament. That's one of the things I've done in sobriety is taking up bowling. And I was going over there to a tournament. I usually go with a team, but this was a singles tournament, and because of my schedule, I couldn't go with the girls I usually go with. And that afternoon, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. There was nothing particularly wrong in my life. There was no chaos going on. Things were really pretty good, but I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And it occurred to me, I'm alone, I'm going to Warner Robins, I'm checking into a motel, and the lie. Who would ever know? You know, and I thought, oh, you know, I don't like this. I've either got to turn around and go home or get there before 8 o'clock so I can find a meeting. And then I remember I had some tapes in my car. And we'd just been at a conference with Burns from Louisville. And he gave a real enthusiastic talk that Sunday. And so I took Burns' tape out and popped it in the tape player and started listening. And I began feeling a little better and a little better. And I started coming up upon Warner Robins, and I thought that the road my hotel was on was going to intersect with the road I was on. So I swung by Kentucky Fried Chicken and picked up some dinner and looked for my road and kept on driving and listening to this tape. And finally I thought, well, I think I've gone a little too far. I need to stop and ask directions. So I pulled over on the side of the road and pulled into a Magic Market and asked him where Eisenhower Boulevard was. And he said, oh, it's no problem for you to find it, lady, but first you got to go 20 miles back to Warner Robins. I mean, I'd just really gotten into this tape. And I just laughed. I said, you know, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I was thinking about that instead of me. I'd gotten back out of myself. You know, I really do believe that it's my self-centeredness and self-will that gets me into trouble all the time. I'm so grateful for the way our lives are today, that there are so many people in our lives that call, that want help. Because it never fails that when I'm just kind of, I lose my spiritual enthusiasm. If I will pick up the phone and call someone, one of the girls I'm sponsoring, or they will call me, it's gone. The pieces fall back into place pretty quickly, and I can move on. I'm so very grateful for that. I'm so very grateful for all these young people who have come into our lives. I grew up in the kind of home that, you know, you called first before you showed up. And there were people in our house, but you always called first, and everything had to be just right before they could walk in the door. And our home isn't like that anymore. As a matter of fact, half these people own keys, and a lot of times they're home when I get there. And which is good. They make the coffee, and it's ready when we get home. And that's just been a whole different experience for me, to have people be able to show up at my back door, and it's okay. And I don't always have to drop everything I'm doing, you know, and straighten everything up. There are an awful lot of girls getting sober in Columbus, Georgia, who are driving carpools with me to the dancing school. You know, I drag them along with me, and off we go. And I'm so grateful that they have come into our lives. It's just been a real joyous experience. There are two young guys in particular that were hanging around, I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago now. And it was New Year's, it was right after Christmas. And we asked Chris and John if they wanted to have a New Year's Eve party at our house for all the young people in the program. And they said, yeah, that'd be wonderful. So they brought in some speakers, they're about as big as this podium. And we cleared all the furniture out of the living room and bought a bunch of sodas and pretzels and potato chips. And at about 9:30 on New Year's Eve, after everyone had been to a meeting, they all showed up at our house and we turned up the music and boogied in the New Year. And it was a ball. We really had a good time. And it's, you know, I'd tell Earth people about this and they'd go, "You what?" And I said, you don't understand. These guys, they'll even clean up after themselves. You know how we are. They clean up their ashtrays and drinks and everything. Well, at about 1 o'clock that morning, there were about 13 of us left. And somebody in the crowd said, let's have a meeting. I said, oh, that's a great idea. Good way to start the new year. And so we sat down and began to have a meeting. As we sat there by the light of our Christmas tree, I realized that we were sitting on our back porch in our rocking chairs talking about God and serenity, and I was joyously free. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy.